On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm a longshoreman here at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and we're out here in the front lines fighting for the American working class, so, you know, we're throwing our hat in with the one guy that really stands behind our values. We're pretty militant about our stance and our values and our beliefs, and, you know, Hillary's just not going to cut it.
Carlos Andrade, a longshoreman at a Bernie Sanders rally this morning at the Port of L.A. The ports of L.A. and Long Beach are a big source of blue-collar union jobs in Southern California. But in recent years, the ports have been plagued by labor disputes, growing competition, and other challenges. So what is the state of our ports today? Jack O'Connell is an international trade advisor at Beacon Economics, an L.A.-based research and consulting firm. Welcome.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. So why would a politician like Bernie Sanders be at the port today? How significant are the ports here as blue-collar, middle-class job generators?
Well, there's a certain irony in Bernie Sanders being at the ports and the ILWU supporting Sanders. ILWU jobs going forward would depend upon a growing volume of international trade moving through the ports. Bernie Sanders is a candidate noted for his very skeptical views about foreign trade and globalization. So it's an odd mix there.
Right. Although many people, he included, blame globalization for a loss in union jobs and a loss in well-paid American jobs.
Well, that's true. But the as far as the ILWU goes, their bread and butter is moving boxes or large containers through the ports of L.A. and Long Beach. And the ports themselves are better off now than they were a year ago when we were coming out of a period of labor turmoil. But the ports do face enormous challenges going forward, not the least of which is the expanded Panama Canal, which opens in about a month.
So how would that affect, negatively affect, the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach?
The volume of cargo moving into the ports, particularly on the import side, about 70% of that is bound for markets somewhere else in North America. The expectation is that to some extent there'll be a diversion of some of that cargo to all water routes moving through the Panama Canal through to ports on the East and Gulf Coast nearer to the ultimate destinations of some of these cargoes. So there is a prospect that the ports of L.A. and Long Beach will see some degree of diversion, which might reduce the volume of cargo going through the port. To maintain jobs, to keep the ports viable, they're going to have to take steps to increase the amount of trade moving through the ports. So this is going to be a neat trick for them to pull off, given the competition they face, not only from the expanded set of locks at Panama, but also from some very aggressive ports in the Pacific Northwest and in British Columbia. They're also vying for trans-Pacific cargoes.
Hmm. So would the ports here have to retrofit themselves or change themselves in major ways to accommodate these bigger ships?
Yes, and in fact, they're in the process of doing so. Both the ports of L.A. and Long Beach are moving ahead with more automated or fully automated terminals, which should expedite the movement of containers through the ports. You're right to note that this part of the stress that the ports face has been the result of larger and larger ships. Panama Canal was built with the expectation that the larger ships they would see would not be much more than 10,000, you know, carrying 10,000 TEUs or 20-foot equivalent unit containers. We're seeing vessels now calling at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach that are upwards of 18,000 TEUs. So this poses a great stress, and it forces the ports to change their entire business plans.
Wow, so 18,000 containers. How do you get those on and off ships efficiently and quickly?
You coordinate your efforts a lot better. The Benjamin Franklin, a ship that called at the ports starting late last year, owned by a French shipping line, has a capacity of 18,000 TEUs. That ships of that size, particularly if they start turning up on a normal, regular, routine basis, pose a tremendous strain on the ports by creating unprecedented surges of cargo. So the ports not only have to, the terminal operators of the ports, the railroads, the trucking lines, the longshore unions, everybody involved in moving goods in and out of the ports have to work in concert. And this is particularly difficult given that a number of these parties have historically adversarial relations.
You mean the different unions?
Yes.
Right. So what does this say to you about the union strength in the ports?
Well, it's proven itself to, the union's proven that it can be a tremendous obstacle to moving goods efficiently and economically through the ports. On the other hand, they're an indispensable partner. And to the extent that they are fully cooperative and see their future in terms of expanding the volume of trade going through the ports, then that's a healthy sign. We'll see a lot of what happens as we move toward a renegotiation of the contract between the ILWU and the terminal operators and steamship lines. There's some effort to get that going ahead of schedule and to actually arrive at a contract of a longer time frame to ensure that there's an adequate time of almost guaranteed labor peace.
So what would happen if the Trans-Pacific Partnership were approved to the local economy around the ports?
It would normally boost the volume of cargo moving through the ports. So that's something that the ILWU would seemingly have supported. So it's somewhat of a question of why it is that they're supporting Bernie Sanders. The general impact of the port of the Trans-Pacific Agreement would be to increase the volumes of a lot of trade, say, in agricultural products. The chief beneficiaries, though, would be companies which have intellectual property rights to protect.
It should be noted, though, that all the candidates are now opposed to the TPP.
Well, we've seen Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton's ultimate position on this is something that remains to be seen.
So there's another problem, too, and that is the ports are a huge source of pollution. Diesel trucks and the ships themselves generating emissions and polluting our air. And the port has fallen short on implementing changes in this area. So what would be the economic impact of tougher environmental regulations on the ports?
It could be very considerable. First thing is the ports are a lot cleaner than they once were. Over the last 10 years, they've made tremendous strides in eliminating or sharply reducing the volume of pollution coming out of the smokestacks, for example, of ships that are at dock, and reducing the amount of particulate matter coming from diesel engines and trucks servicing the ports. There still remains a lot to be done, and in fact, with the ports, the entire transportation industry in the state is anticipating that sometime later this year, the Brown administration will announce a new set of increasingly stringent air quality regulations that, in the case of the ports, will force the ports to utilize more zero-emission or near-zero-emission equipment, ranging from the cranes that move containers on and off ships to the various conveyances that are used to transport containers around the ports and directly off the ports. So this could result in a very substantial bill. One study by an engineering firm earlier this year estimated that it would cost about three times the amount. Compliance with these regulations would cost three times the amount to the ports of what they would normally look at over the next 20 or 30 years in normal replacement of equipment.
Jock O'Connell, International Trade Advisor at Beacon Economics. Thanks for joining us, Jock.
Thanks, Marilyn. Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's take a broader look now at how California is reacting to all the love it's getting from the presidential candidates. All three have been all over the state. It's just a little more than a week out from the primary, but New Jersey also votes June 7th, and its polls close hours before ours do. And so it is possible that the Democratic race could be sewn up before all California voters have gone to the polls. Hillary Clinton could reach the 2,383 delegates needed to secure the nomination. But a loss in California would be a huge blow for her. And according to the latest poll, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are tied among likely primary voters. Here to talk about all of this is Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Hi, Rafe.
Hello.
And Mindy Romero is the director of the California Civic Engagement Project at the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. Welcome, Mindy.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Rafe, let's begin with you. If Hillary Clinton wins New Jersey and she gets enough delegates to snag the nomination, will California voters turn out?
Oh, I think California voters are going to turn out. They're very energized. Look, everybody knows that she's going to win the nomination. I mean, most people know she's going to win the nomination. So I don't think New Jersey is going to make that big a difference, except that she crosses the line. People are very energized. They're registering in large numbers. They want to have their voice heard. I think they're going to vote.
Okay, well, let's talk about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's tactics here in California. Sanders, as we heard earlier today, is campaigning in San Pedro. He was in East LA. He was in Lancaster. He'll be in the Central Valley over the weekend. What's his strategy?
His strategy is to win congressional districts and to just collect some extra delegates. The Democratic race is so proportional in terms of the rules that you need kind of a gigantic victory to get a big edge in delegates. But one way to get them is to go a district at a time. He's going where the leader's not going, and that's a standard upstart tactic in California, is to go away from the big areas and try to collect places where they have. Now, he's not necessarily all that comfortable in those areas, which is kind of an oddity of his campaign, but it's probably a good idea to go there.
Yeah. So, as I said, he's going to the Central Valley. And Mindy, what are the big issues there in the rural parts of California?
I think many of the issues in the Central Valley are the issues that people care about, or issues that people care about statewide, right? So you've got the standard players, you know, education and the economy and jobs, and depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, if you're a Republican, you're going to be thinking about terrorism and security, national security more, worried about taxes and income distribution to some degree as well. And if you're a Democrat, you're going to be thinking more about economic inequality. And Latinos, to some degree, are thinking about immigration issues, although that typically is not a major issue, but it is an issue that can dominate the outreach to Latinos in a political campaign. And so it's something that becomes very much a part of the discussion and a part of what people are thinking and weighing when they're deciding which candidates are going to be good for them and good for their community.
Well, let's talk about the Latino vote in particular. And, you know, it has been assumed that Hillary Clinton has a big advantage with Latino voters, but that seems to be playing out differently along generational lines.
It does. And, you know, we've seen some shifting polls, I should say, when we talk about the Latino community just in general. You know, we saw a huge lead for Clinton over Sanders amongst Latinos couple of months ago. Then we saw a shift, and one poll said it was really, really close, and now the PPIC just put out a poll and said, you know, almost a dead heat generally, but for Latinos, Clinton still has a pretty commanding lead, about 9 percentage points. But when we split it by age, young, you know, under 34, particularly 18 to 24-year-olds in the Latino community are supporting Sanders in big numbers, not unlike, you know, when we see millennials in general. There's a lot of support for Sanders, and it typically is in the Latino community, the older segments of the community that are supporting Clinton, and those also are the ones that have higher turnout, though, and that's important to note.
Right. And so, Rafe, does that help explain why the polls have narrowed in recent days and the two candidates are now pretty much neck and neck?
Yeah, I think the polls are catching up to the reality. I think this big surge of registration is among young voters principally, and that's very, very recent. And I think it's underestimating Sanders' support probably going in. I think you shouldn't try to predict anything here, but I think that Sanders at least has a fighting chance of finishing ahead of her because of that.
And also the independent votes, because independents or declined to state can vote in the Democratic primary.
Yes, I also think they're the least likely to turn out to vote. But if somebody just registered, I think you can assume that someone who just registered is going to vote.
Yeah, and I would add, typically, any given election, those that are registered as independent or NPP, right, no party preference, they have much lower turnout rates, often 10 percentage points lower than Democrats or Republicans. But then you add on this additional component of it being a primary, and NPP folks have to actually, you know, request a ballot, right, if they're going to be voting by mail. And we know that the vast majority of NPP folks in California have independents have not requested a ballot with Democratic candidates on it. So they're going to get their ballot without Democratic candidates on it. And we imagine that a good chunk of those, you know, will be confused by that and maybe end up not, well, certainly not voting maybe Democratic, but you know, might be confused about what their options are in terms of going to the polls and voting there. And so you could lose even more independents that way.
So we hear a lot about the Latino vote, 28% eligible to vote, much fewer, much lower voter turnout. But let's talk about the Asian vote. I mean, if you can say there is an Asian vote, Mindy, and what's happening there?
Well, Asian Americans also turn out to vote in low numbers, like Latinos do. I mean, lower in terms of what you would expect based on their population proportions. We would expect in this election a primary also to see, you know, a big gap between Asian Americans and the rest of the electorate. The question is, how motivated will Asian Americans be? Can we see higher turnout than what we would normally expect? Can we see high turnout for Asian Americans in a primary? And I think we're going to see high turnout for everyone. But we see a lot of mobilization around the Latino vote right now, and less so around Asian Americans for this primary, I would say. And so it depends on how much they're motivated and independently, and then also how much people can organize them. And I think that still remains to be seen how high of a turnout rate we'll see for that group.
And Rafe, we mentioned that Donald Trump will also be in the Central Valley, which is also, you know, a reliable base for conservative votes. Is there a big level of support for Donald Trump in the Central Valley? And since he has secured the Republican nomination, will people actually turn out to vote?
Well, I think that second one is a big question. I think there's plenty of support for Donald Trump throughout the state among Republicans. There's a lot of Republicans who aren't very happy about the state of their party right now, as indicated in the recent PPIC poll. The Central Valley is very much now a competitive area. It's both conservative and liberal, Republican and Democratic. It's a smart thing for him to be in a place like Fresno, where there's a real close partisan balance, and he might even get just some sort of a good buzz there that he might not get in Los Angeles and San Francisco, I would say. But he's going to have a struggle in California overall, because the issues that he's been pushing, especially immigration, even in the Central Valley, there's a lot of support for immigration reform among conservatives, because of just the nature of the economy in the Central Valley. So I think he'll have plenty of friends there, plenty of people to cheer for him, but not everyone's going to be too thrilled with him.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA, and Mindy Romero, Director of the California Civic Engagement Project at UC Davis. And as the candidates have focused on California, what has been your reaction? Have you changed your mind about who you like, or has seeing them up close reinforced your support for your candidate? What's your takeaway? We want to hear it. Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we'll look at the Libertarian Party, once considered fringe. Its ideas have been embraced by the Koch brothers and leaders in Silicon Valley. And the party's leading presidential candidate is polling at 10%. Is this their moment? That's next on Press Play.
Santa Monica Bay's public radio station, KCRW, relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. While the mainstream candidates are battling it out in California, libertarians are gathering in Florida this weekend. They hold their nominating convention in Orlando. And unlike the past, they're getting a lot of attention this year. In recent polls, leading libertarian candidate Gary Johnson nabs 10% of the general election vote for president. And unpopularity for the major party candidates is high. Could 2016 be the year for the party to have a real impact this November? Brian Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering the presidential race, and he joins us from the Libertarian Convention in Orlando. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is it like there at the convention?
Well, it's a bit more freewheeling than the political conventions I've covered in the past. Delegates are pretty free to walk up to the presidential nominees who are sort of milling about, and the candidates, I'm sorry, not the nominees. And, you know, there's a real effort to work the floor by the people that are trying to run for the presidential nomination and the vice presidential nomination. That is not something you see at the Democratic and Republican conventions.
So, yeah, and the leading candidate is Gary Johnson, former New Mexico governor, and he ran last time around. Is he likely to get the nomination?
Well, so nothing is certain here. Libertarian conventions have a habit of being unpredictable. At least that's what veterans of this process say. And he is facing a rather stiff challenge from an activist named Austin Peterson, who's making the case that Gary Johnson is what he calls a failed Republican politician. And Mr. Peterson is making the argument that the party should stop nominating failed Republicans and start nominating successful libertarians. So, you know, it's all very unclear. It's not like the Democratic and Republican conventions. It is a completely open process. There are open ballots. No one is bound. No one is required to vote a certain way because of the results of primaries and caucuses. So a lot is in flux. That said, Gary Johnson was the party standard bearer in 2012 and has a lot of goodwill among a contingent of party regulars. So we'll see. And, you know, as you note, he is doing very well in the polls. So that could very well for a libertarian, I should say. So that could factor into some of the decision making by the delegates.
And his running mate is William Weld, former Massachusetts governor.
So that's right. Yes.
Yeah, so that's curious. Two pretty formerly mainstream politicians, Massachusetts is hardly a conservative state, running on the libertarian ticket. What does that tell you about this party and its bid to become more mainstream?
Well, I have to tell you that the Weld vice presidential running mate pick was not something that went over super well with a lot of the delegates here. Weld, during his time in Massachusetts, he, especially on gun control issues, sort of angered a lot of libertarian-leaning activists, and so he's pro-gun control in some ways, and libertarians, generally speaking, are not. Gary Johnson ran in New Mexico and governed in New Mexico as a very fiscally conservative but socially liberal politician, so he fits in a little bit better with the Libertarian Party's ethos. But, you know, Governor Johnson's calculation was that a ticket with two sort of moderate and popular governors, both of whom were elected twice, could be a real force to be reckoned with in November and perhaps deliver one of the strongest showings that the party has ever seen.
Well, especially when you look at recent polling and how the high unfavorable ratings are for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, do they feel like, given that, plus these two candidates, that the party, this is their moment now?
You know, I certainly think that is the case. We've seen a number of polls now. The Wall Street Journal NBC poll showed 47% of Americans are open to a candidate beyond the Republicans and the Democrats. We've seen that in other polling, including a lot of young people. There was one poll that showed 91% of voters under 29 were looking for a non-Democratic or non-Republican candidate. And Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are two of the most unpopular nominees for their parties ever. So libertarians are hoping that this political environment, this kind of instability and this kind of dislike for both major party candidates could really make this a special year for them.
So earlier this week, we spoke with Jane Mayer about the Koch brothers and how they've declined to support Donald Trump, so far at least. Would they be interested in supporting the Libertarian candidate, do you think?
So there were rumors to that effect a few weeks ago, but they were quickly denied by folks in the Koch organizations. David Koch actually was the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party in the 1980 presidential race, so he does have some history with the party. On the other hand, in recent years, they've really thrown their lot in with Republicans and have made it their mission to push the Republican Party in a more libertarian direction rather than run and work outside of the two-party system. So I don't think right now it's likely that the Libertarian Party will get a big boost from either of the Koch brothers, but anything is possible. The Kochs have indicated that they plan to spend millions of dollars on the Republican Senate and House races across the country. So they're still sticking largely with the Republican Party, but anything is possible.
Yeah, I know. This is the year of the anything is possible line. And so it sounds like is there's a schism within the Libertarian Party between the party stalwarts who want it to remain pure and untainted by the major political parties and the other side who wants to make it more mainstream. Because it seems looking at the people who are running, you do have, as we were talking about, Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, but also John McAfee, who, if people remember, is this eccentric software tycoon who fled Belize under some cloud of suspicion of some man being shot on his property, et cetera, et cetera. And he's running for president.
That's right. And kind of this debate mirrors what's happening in both the Republican and Democratic parties, that we've seen populist insurgencies in both of them in the form of Donald Trump, who eventually captured the nomination, and Bernie Sanders, who really did and is giving Hillary Clinton a run for her money. So there certainly is a contingent of the activists and delegates here in Orlando that believe that the party should nominate someone who is a true libertarian rather than a former Republican office holder who happens to hold libertarian-like views. And so there is something of a schism between different camps of libertarian delegates attending the convention. On the other hand, you know, it has to weigh on them that they're seeing a libertarian candidate for the first time ever polling at 10 or 11% in a couple of national polls, and that's almost striking distance from getting into the presidential debate. So there is this pragmatism versus purity argument and debate going on here in Orlando.
Yeah, so you would need 15% to get in on the debates, right?
Yes, so the Commission on Presidential Debates sets a 15% polling threshold for party for participation in the debate. So the last time we saw a third party candidate participate in the debates was Ross Perot during his run in the 90s, and we haven't had one since. And Gary Johnson is in three polls pretty close to that. So, you know, I think that might potentially be a factor in some of these delegates' votes if they can get past the fact that he and his potential running mate have a couple of unorthodoxies when it comes to libertarian positions.
Brian Tao covers the presidential race for the Wall Street Journal. He's at the Libertarian Convention in Florida this weekend. Thanks, Byron.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, are you an independent voter? Are you possibly leaning libertarian this election? We would love to hear from you at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it's Memorial Day weekend, so it follows that there is yet another X-Men movie out. We've also got an Alice in Wonderland sequel and a documentary about cults.
So if you're into big 80s ponytails and documentaries about what's wrong with the human soul, I cannot recommend Holy Hell harder.
It's the movie roundup. It's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's only May, but summer blockbuster season is in full swing. This week, another X-Men film and an Alice in Wonderland sequel. Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a film critic for The New Republic. Welcome back.
Hi there.
Hi. And Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the new movie podcast called Skill Set. Welcome back, Amy.
Hello, Madeline.
All right, let's start with the biggie, X-Men Apocalypse.
Ever since the world found out about mutants in 73, there have been cults who see them as some kind of second coming or sign of God. I was tracking one of them. They call themselves a Shir En Sebanur, named after an ancient being they believe to be the world's first.
World's first what?
The world's first mutant.
Aha. We've seen these mutants before. This is the ninth movie in this series.
Yes.
Anything new, Tim?
This is actually one of my favorites of the series, I have to say. You know, we now live in a comic book era where you don't just have one superhero. You have 10. And what's funny about the X-Men movies, the first one came out in 2000, they've always had a ton of superheroes. And I think what works in the X-Men universe better than, say, even the Avengers world is that not everybody deserves their own standalone movie. There are a lot of characters in the X-Men who are perfectly happy to be like the supporting characters. And so even though there's a ton of heroes, there's a new bad guy in this one, I feel like everybody's sort of proportionally put into this movie where they belong. I think Michael Fassbender continues to be sort of the high watermark of this series. The bad guy is played by Oscar Isaac, who plays Apocalypse, this millennia-old sort of force who wants to predictably take over the Earth and enslave humanity and destroy humanity. He's buried under makeup and all this costume stuff. So if you're really looking for a great Oscar Isaac performance, this is not the movie for that.
Go back to Star Wars.
Go back to Inside Llewyn Davis. But I think this movie is very entertaining, and as opposed to a lot of comic book movies, this one is actually, I think, emotional and about something as opposed to just being lots of heroes fighting one another.
And Amy, Bryan Singer back directing this one.
He directed the first one. Also directed The Usual Suspects. I'm with Tim. I adored this movie, and I feel like I should say that with a caveat. I do not care about X-Men. I have no loyalty to this. I have no dog in this fight. I'm just in it for a good movie, and I enjoyed this so much. The setting here is 1983. You know, the last three that they've done in this kind of mini reboot of a sort, where they've made everybody younger, added Michael Fassbender, who I thought was so much better as Magneto than he is in Macbeth this year.
Oh, absolutely.
He's terrible in Macbeth. He's a wonderful Magneto. Yeah. But they've been aging it forward decade by decade, and now we're in 1983, which means this X-Men has the most amazing costumes. Just terrible high-waisted jeans.
Those are
rushed
back now,
t-shirts.
By the way.
I'm wearing a pair right now, actually. But they're wonderful. They're wonderful when I wear them. They're terrible when Cyclops wears them. And I just loved the setting of this. I love that this is a movie where you have Eurythmics and Ronald Reagan, you know, jostling side by side. Because also what makes X-Men different is they're not set in this alternate reality where there's like Gothams and fake cities. They're set in one where it's like, oh no, Magneto's in trouble because he tried to kill Nixon. And here Reagan is everywhere. And you're aware of the Eastern Bloc. You're aware of like geopolitical problems.
So it has a serious real world tinge to it.
Well, you know what's so funny is this is what this movie boils down to is a fight, and stop me when this sounds familiar, between one group of people who think the world is in trouble and want to burn it all down, hate the system, think it should be destroyed.
Did you say the word burn?
People.
Yes.
Yes, I did.
Okay,
and then the other people led by Professor X, James McAvoy, who think you can fix it. And this is that same clash that I had in the car driving to see the movie with my friend. And so I think that's what a fantasy film is when it's at its best.
Yeah.
When you see the real world reflected with men in capes.
Okay, let's talk about another fantasy film, Alice Through the Looking Glass. This is a sequel to Tim Burton's take on Alice in Wonderland.
Have I come at a bad time?
On the contrary, you were afraid you weren't coming at all.
What's the matter?
The Hatter's the matter.
Or the matter of the Hatter. The former.
No, the latter.
He's mad.
Yes, I know. That's what makes him so... him.
But he's grown darker. Less dafter, denies himself laughter. Mm.
And no scheme of ours can raise any sort of smile. We'd rather hoped you might help us save him.
Okay, is this movie saved? Savable?
I do have a dog in this fight. And on behalf of Lewis Carroll, I am upset that we made a movie where the Mad Hatter looks at Alice and says, help me find my mommy and daddy. With no trace of irony. Lewis Carroll, I'm surprised this zombie is not here, like, booing and throwing popcorn at the screen. There's no wit. There's no poetry.
This is not directed by Tim Burton, by the way.
No, this is by James Bobbin, who did, I thought, the two really good recent Muppet movies. He did Muppets and Muppets Most Wanted. And I actually hoped that he would kind of bring this light touch that Burton has long since lost. He is sadly buried under this Tim Burton aesthetic. It looks... You would not be able to tell that Burton didn't direct this one. It feels the same way as the 2010 original. I can't articulate
which
clearly.
Which was super popular, so super you popular, could see why he would want to do
but
that.
But I would say that I think that part of the reason that movie was so popular was it was the first 3D movie after Avatar, and I think people had such a craving for 3D at that time. I thought that movie was not good. I think this movie is absolutely wretched. It's filled with actors you used to like who are now awful. Sacha Baron Cohen, Helena Bonham Carter, Anne Hathaway is in this again as she was. I mean, Johnny Depp is. Amy and I actually talked about this at Cannes. There needs to be some sort of moratorium, I feel like, on Johnny Depp movies.
Him just not wearing crazy makeup. Let's start there.
Even when he's not in makeup, he's got to put on those weird contacts. I mean, he owns an island. Can we just send him there for a while?
Yeah, this movie is, I found, absolutely joyless. And I agree with Amy. For me, like, the Lewis Carroll-ness of this movie is just turned into this cutesy abomination. Everything is sort of gaudy and stupid and cutesy.
I've never seen a movie work this hard to be so ugly. Like, yeah. Every character has CGI eyeballs. And the coloring, the design of it, it's like if you gave 100 kids a crayon and said, you're all in charge, make something.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, it's garish. It's monstrous.
Yeah. I hated this
movie. It's probably going to make a lot of money.
I don't think so. I hope not. If anybody listens to us, maybe that won't happen.
Okay. Let's talk about something that seems a lot different. It's called The Idol. It's about the winner of Arab Idol, the Middle Eastern version of American Idol. And this is actually, Tim, based on a true story.
Yeah. This young man who lived in Gaza in 2013 won Arab Idol, the Middle Eastern version. And it's directed by Hani Abu Assad, who is more known for more serious dramatic fare. He's been nominated for two different foreign language Oscars for Paradise Now and Omar. And what's interesting about his new movie, The Idol, is that the same themes are there about Palestinian life and the hardships that they face, but it's done through the context of what's essentially a feel-good, entertaining movie about this young guy who's trying to get onto Arab Idol. Because he lives in Gaza and because the show takes place in Egypt, he needs to get a visa, which is not easy for him to do. And so on one level, the movie's just sort of a feel-good, can this young kid reach his dreams? But on another level, a much more emotional level, it's about a young guy who doesn't have many opportunities and is sort of surrounded by poverty, surrounded by sort of the political environment that he lives in. And so this is really kind of...
Political is this movie?
I think that most people can watch this movie and it will just be sort of in the background. I mean, I think that in the past, Abu Assad's films can be very strident. This movie is a lot less so. I think what he does, much to his credit, he really lets the movie's material dictate. And so this one is much more kind of crowd-pleasing. It's much more accessible. There's a political undercurrent, but it doesn't get sort of shoved down your throat. This is easily the most entertaining movie he's ever made. But at the same time, I think you do walk away from it thinking, what are the issues at play? What does this young man have to deal with to reach his dreams?
It seems like we've seen this plot played out many, many times before. The underdog, the kid from nowhere who reaches fame and stardom, the unlikely.
Yeah, the slumdog millionaire kind of thing. I mean, I would not say that it is his sort of best or most ambitious film, but I think in terms of a change of pace, if we want to talk about how to get a message across and sometimes sort of sugarcoating it through a very kind of entertaining vehicle, I think a movie like The Idol is how you do it. It may not be his best movie, but I think it's the type of movie that will travel in a way that maybe some of his earlier movies haven't.
Okay, last up today, a documentary about a cult. It's called Holy Hell, and here's a clip from the trailer.
It's not like we were forced to be there. We wanted to be there.
He always told us we're an anti-cult.
I was hallucinating, colors were moving around him, and I thought, I found it.
I really felt like I had a purpose in my life.
He just became stranger and stranger and more paranoid and more possessive.
You can't say no. No is against the rules.
He wanted to be worshipped. He wanted to be God.
If you can't stand naked in front of your master, you can't stand naked in front of your God.
All right, Amy, you've seen this movie. Tell us a little bit about who this cult leader is.
This was one of my favorite films out of Sundance this year, and I'm so excited it's coming out. They are describing a man named Michel, who was the leader of a group called the Buddha Field. And Michel is a failed actor with an accent you can't place at all. And he was a very vain man who told people that if they stuck with him, he would give them the knowing, which is this direct route to all of the knowledge of God. So the filmmaker of this documentarian, Will Allen, joined Buddha Field back in the early 80s. He's a true believer. And when he joined, Michel put him in charge of documenting what the cult was going to do, because he was just very proud of everything they were doing over there. And so you watch these like happy, idealistic people join this cult and have no idea it's a cult, as you hear them saying. They're convinced it's not. They're convinced it's just a better way to live. And he gets all of this amazing footage so that when things go sour, 25 years later, he's in this cult for 25 years, he has this incredible document of mind control and of how Michel warped everybody. And this Michel character, you guys have to see him to believe that this man is even real. He lives in Speedos. He's deeply tan. He's incredibly vain. This is the sort of cult where everybody renounces everything, your family, your possessions, it all goes to him. But at the same time, what it prizes more than anything is beauty. And Michel is telling everyone they have to work out, they have to get plastic surgery like him. He only wants attractive people in this cult. And so it's this amazing, like...
Wow, it's perfect for California.
A lot of it takes place in California.
So I guess things go sour, as cults often do.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the one cult with a happy ending. This does not have the happy ending, but what I really admire about this documentary is Will Allen doesn't make it like a monster movie. You know, it's not one of those dark, unsolved mysteries, you know, suspicious thrillers. He's trying to understand how he and over 150 people joined this cult. And like, he's trying to reconcile the fact that they really thought they were doing the right thing with what went wrong. And so it's got this empathy to it, I think, that a lot of films about cults don't.
And do we ever find out about Michel, where he came from and what his motivation really was?
A little bit. I will say he has a bit part in Rosemary's Baby.
Really?
Yeah.
Which character is he?
I think he's just one of the guys who glares when Rosemary walks by. But there he is. That was his big movie claim to fame. And he's still around. There's an epilogue of this. I think people are going to be like jaw dropped, pick it up, grab their popcorn, leave, and make some phone calls when this film ends.
Well, it is really interesting that so many of these cults did take place here in Southern California and California in general in the 1970s and 80s. And is there any discussion about why this is such a fertile ground for so many different cults?
I think in a way because, you know, this is one of the areas where dreamers go. You know, you have things you want to accomplish. You believe in utopias. And I almost feel silly bringing this background to X-Men, but because this is a documentary set in the early 80s, you have a lot of gorgeous people in 80s swimwear doing like religious chants. So if you're into big 80s ponytails and documentaries about what's wrong with the human soul, I cannot recommend Holy Hell harder.
So double bill, X-Men and Holy Hell together.
I have a very limited palette of things I love.
Sounds like a good weekend to me. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the new movie podcast. It's called Skill Set. Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a film critic for The New Republic. Speaking of big ponytails, how watching people playing video games has created a thing called e-sports. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Pac-12 TV network has announced a new esports competition for Pac-12 schools. Yes, video gaming is officially a Pac-12 sport. Last month, Arizona State won the Heroes of the Dorm tournament. The finals took place in front of 67,000 fans at CenturyLink Stadium in Seattle.
Akafe's taken lots of damage, but they are going for the core.
Illidan isn't here for 15 seconds. The damage now on the core. DX Nina trying to apply shields. Akafe's low on HP, but the core is going down. That's it's going to be
GG! Arizona State, your champions. They are the heroes of the
Okay, if that didn't make any sense to you at all, you probably do not play multiplayer online battle arena games known as MOBAs. More than $500,000 in scholarship money was at stake in that one. But that pales in comparison to what the pro video gamers could make playing at last year's Dota 2 tournament, where $18 million in prize money was at stake. Jacob Wolf is senior writer at ESPN. His job there is to cover esports. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, you work for ESPN. That's a sports network. How is video gaming a sport?
Well, you know, overall, video gaming has become extremely competitive. And despite contrary to popular belief, it does require a lot of skill, especially mentally and even some physically. Currently, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, which is my hometown originally, covering a Counter-Strike Global Offensive tournament. And one of the big things with Counter-Strike is these players have to have a ton of muscle memory in terms of their arms and where to move their mouse, and hand-eye coordination comes with that. It's really, really, really difficult, and it requires just as much practice as traditional sports. You have players that play 12 hours a day and live in gaming houses with their teammates. It's really, really cemented itself as a sport, in my opinion.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like endurance there with the 12 hours, but do you train for it physically? Is there a special diet besides Red Bull?
I mean, a lot of players, a lot of teams are actually getting into doing that more. I know I was talking to one of the teams, Cloud9. They're one of the biggest organizations in esports. And their general manager, who is he's super into like going to the gym and everything, he's been taking a lot of their players more into the gym. And like, it's not required, but it's very much encouraged by a lot of these teams, because the more endurance you have, and like more muscle power and just being able to last, as well as like eating well and having a proper life and getting good sleep, like promotes you to be active and aware when you're playing these games. So they're definitely encouraged by most of the top teams that you're active and fit.
Okay, let's talk about the top teams and how much can you make if you're a top video gamer professional?
It really depends. I know several encounter. It depends per game, right? So like, one of the biggest sources of incomes for esports players is Twitch, which is a live streaming platform where when they do individual practice, what is called solo queue in League of Legends especially, they stream this out and they interact with their fans. Well, a lot of these fans enjoy the stream. They subscribe for like $5 a month, which like $3 of that per person goes to these players. And then additionally, there's donations, where you have people that donate $1,000 here, $1,000 there. I think like the biggest donation I've ever seen on a stream was like $6,000 from one person.
What are they donating for?
They're donating because they like the stream. Like it's literally because they are enjoying watching this player play and interact with his fans.
And they just want this player to have the money?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It's very cool. It's a very interesting and giving community.
Uh-huh. And so Amazon bought Twitch for $1 billion.
Yeah, it was a gigantic sale. It made a lot of sense. Twitch is the giant. There's other competitors, and I'm sure my editor's listening to this. He used to work for Azubu, which is Twitch's main competitor. But nonetheless, Twitch has competitors, but nothing is quite like Twitch. And Twitch has everything that is notable, from giant esports competitions to the small ones. Mm-hmm. And then also just standard video gaming as well, where you just have people that like to stream. They don't want to be competitive. And they play single-player games. So it's a mix of a little bit of everything.
And then also it's on TBS, right? Turner Broadcasting has its own esports league?
That debuts tonight, yes. It's been on Twitch all week, and then the debut on TBS will be tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern time.
So what does that say to you about how mainstream this is getting?
It's definitely getting mainstream. And what I've really liked about being here at E-League with Turner and covering it for ESPN, The beauty of it is everyone said all the talent that, have worked at other esports events. My mentor, Richard Lewis, who used to be a journalist and has now turned a host, and he works at Turner. Like, everyone has said Turner came to us and they asked us what we wanted to do. They didn't, like, Turner has been very welcoming to the esports space. They didn't come in with a bunch of ideals. They wanted to do Counter-Strike, and they went to the people that knew Counter-Strike. And, like, that's been the big storyline here, is that, Turner's listened, and just they've done an amazing job all week with production. And I'm really excited to see what tonight brings, so.
So is it fair to say that the fans who watch people play the games created this as a sport?
Really depends. I mean, each one individually has its own come up. Things like Super Smash Brothers, that is definitely a fair assessment, because Smash was like just a bunch of people wanting to get together and play Smash Brothers, and that slowly became esports competitions. League of Legends in particular, like, you did have people that wanted to be competitive. But it really came from the big push for League of Legends to evolve and explode came from its own developer, Riot Games. Hmm. So it's a very case-by-case basis. Each esport has a bit of a different story.
So League of Legends, the World Championship last year, the finals were watched by 36 million viewers worldwide.
Yes.
So how does that compare to how many people watch regular sports?
Like football, I believe it's significantly more. If I remember correctly, there was an article about it being compared to baseball, and it makes the World Series look really tiny in terms of viewing numbers.
So when is it getting to the Olympics? My next question.
There's actually a really interesting story there. There's a Korean committee, and I got to write a story on this. There was a Korean committee that is actually doing all the official Olympic paperwork, and they got a response from the Olympic committee, and now they're putting together everything they need. So if everything would go through, we could see it in the 2020 Olympics.
Wow, really? Wow, that's,
yeah.
I'm astonished. So the top players can make millions of dollars, I guess, in sponsorships and through all these donations and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, the average is like, the average for, the average for everything is like around the $100,000 mark, but it really depends. Like, the really popular players, I would imagine, are quite up there and close to a million, if not at a million.
And how many women are professional video game players?
Well, there's actually a separate division in Counter-Strike that is like a women's league, and there's several teams in there that are very competitive. At the professional level, though, there's only ever been one, and she decided to leave at her own fruition, at least in League of Legends. However, there is a woman competitive StarCraft player named Scarlet, who is very popular, and she's been really good, and she's had a very good career in that game. It's not nearly as common at top level in the other esports. I know, shout-outs, there's a group called the Smash Sisters who, like, go to Smash Brothers events together and compete, and they're not, like, they're nowhere near, like, the people who are in the top five of the game competitively, but, like, they definitely can hold their own, so.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for shedding the light.
Yeah, no problem.
That's Jacob Wolf, senior writer on esports for ESPN. Joey Myers, hello there.
Hang on. ABAC.
Yeah, exactly. You're ready to compete, I can tell.
If any of you could just see me miming my controller there, you'd know that I don't play video games. So we talk politics today like we've been doing all week. It's the biggest story. We wanted to know what the single biggest issue is for California voters. And universally on Facebook, our followers said that affordable housing is the biggest thing that they're looking for candidates to be speaking about. Anthony Williams says, I care most about affordable housing, but as one of your guests said recently, that's not something with an immediate fix.
All right. Thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
Memorial Day weekend,
3 days. Hallelujah. We're going to have a great show for you on Monday, so don't forget to check us out again Monday at noon. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.